Hi folks, welcome to episode 81 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I am of course joined by Bo, and today we're going to be discussing the last in our series of the sort of early English monarchs, Henry I. We will come back to the English crown at some point. It's just we've been doing it for ages now, so we thought it might be worth just, you know, going somewhere else and talking about something else for a while, just to have a bit of a palate cleanse. So, right, as I understand it, because I watched the last episode where I wasn't available, William Rufus got shot in a hunting accident. And so, who's next?
Well, his younger brother, Henry I, who was born in the purple, as they say. Right. Yep. So he's much younger.
Yeah.
And he was born after 1066. Mm-hmm. So that's what that means, being born in the purple.
And so at this point, the Norman monarchy is pretty well established then, right?
Well, you know? It depends which story you want to, but yeah, basically, yeah. It's hard to see otherwise. Although, big part of Henry I's story is just continuing baronial revolts.
Hmm.
They much more come from his own barons rather than sort of English rebels like Hereward or Siward or something.
Like the English peasantry is like, I mean, so this has been what, like 30, 40 years they've been?
Yeah. So William rules for about 20 and then Rufus is about 13 years. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty well solidified. Okay, well, these are the kings now.
Yeah.
You know. Right. So, like you say, the revolt's coming from his own barons. So Norman appointees.
There's no great Anglo-Saxon earl that rises up to really rival him, put it that way.
Right, okay.
And one of the first things to say is he rules for ages 35 years.
Really?
So between those two generations, William the Conqueror and his sons, it's the best part of 70 years.
Mm.
And the world changes with the best will in the world, even back then in the 11th, 12th century. 70 years, the world turns.
Yeah.
And it's a different world by the time of Henry I's death.
You can see ways, like after these sort of long reigns, it's just like, okay, well, it's always been this way, you know, for the English now. They don't remember a time before, so.
It's basically out of living memory pre-66, 1066, by the time Henry I dies.
Yeah.
Because he has, a fairly decent long life and a long reign, 35 odd years.
And surely he's a better man than William Rufus?
Yes. Different. And slightly less just out and out evil.
Good.
But only slightly, really.
I mean, I was enjoying the stories of William Rufus, and I was also thinking, glad he's not my king.
Yeah. He's one of those ones where there's no real wriggle room to do anything other than exactly what he wants.
Hmm.
Right? Hmm. Very, very strong person. And Henry is similar, just slightly less. There's a great quote. I'll read out when we get to it, saying that perhaps he was only slightly less harsh just because he calculated that was better for him, for his position. If he thought it would be better to be more like Rufus, he would have been. But
there is also the possibility that he just wasn't the same sort of raging lunatic. And anyone, even if he's quite harsh, anyone by comparison looks...
Yeah.
Just because they're not quite as manic as Rufus.
I think so.
I mean, Rufus's like open atheism was really weird, right?
Mm.
That's unbelievably unusual.
Yeah.
At the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like normally everyone is shocking. I mean, it's almost unthinkable, frankly.
Mm. Yeah, where'd that come from?
Yeah.
Sort of an aberration. Because William the Conqueror himself was
deeply devout.
Fairly pious. Yeah. Yeah, right.
Like, so, you know, he founded a bunch of churches and abbeys and stuff.
Absolutely.
So, you know, didn't he pray every morning or something like this as well?
He was a pious man for sure. Oh,
like,
yeah.
Because, like, people have got to remember that Christianity was like sciences to us, right? It explains the universe and everything in it and why morality is as it is. And so to say, okay, I'm an atheist back in like the 11th century or the 12th century, it's just like saying, okay, well, I believe actually that God created the earth and that man that used to walk around with dinosaurs. Now, you know, it's the same sort of like, okay, that's a crazy perspective. Mm. You know, what wormholes did he go down reading in the library? It's like, no, it's all nonsense.
Yeah. I think it must have been just
the Socrates guy's got a point.
Yeah. Maybe, I was about to say, maybe he was influenced by, because there were ancient atheists.
Yeah.
People like Socrates, or people that just sort of relentlessly questioned everything in the ancient world. So maybe he was that. Or there's certain times, I don't know if you remember when he was a younger man, at some point you sort of realise, a lot of people, it's when you first go to uni, you realise, oh, all my life decisions are in fact up to me now. There's nobody really, other than the police. There's nobody telling me what to do.
Yeah.
So I can make all my own decisions. Some people, that your mind goes haywire and you go down some crazy weird avenues.
Yeah.
Well, imagine that if you're actually king, there is really nobody, nobody telling you what you can or can't do. Mm. Sometimes that you end up with sort of aberrations, but it's rare. It's super rare, no doubt about that.
I guess, yeah.
Okay, so for the story of Henry I, there's one first thing I'd like to sort of say before we get into sort of the details of his reign and what he did and said and all that sort of thing. First say that the sources are mainly William of Malmesbury, Henry of Huntingdon and Aldrich Vitalis, and of course the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and a few others. But there's this idea of the green tree. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's a bit, it's a little bit obscure, but I'll tell the story of that because it's sort of, it's a really good allegory or metaphor, and some of the histories, some of the sort of modern or actually and contemporary histories mention it. Mm. And what it is, it's a story from the days of Edward the Confessor. Mm-hmm. It may or may not be true, but they thought it was true at the time, so that's good enough.
Yeah.
Where apparently when Edward the Confessor, St. Edward, was on his deathbed, apparently he awoke from sort of some sort of fever dream and said, I've had this dream where a couple of old monks from my childhood came to me and said, after your death in the next generation, after you, Edward the Confessor, dies, England will be absolutely ravaged by war. Apparently the quote is, devil shall come through all this land and with fire and sword and the havoc of war will sort of destroy Britain in all sorts of ways. And that all the main magnates and bishops and things, they're not godly. They're actually Satan's work.
So what he's saying, the Normans are going to be like the devil taking over England.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't have known it would be Normans. It could have been Hardrada.
It could have been the Danes.
But whatever, the conqueror, the confessor, seems to have made some sort of prediction. Hmm. And one of the chronicles and the people around his deathbed said, well, when will God...
That doesn't sound good, does
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that sounds terrifying. And have you got any idea when sort of God's displeasure with England might end, when that might end? And we're told by the chronicles at the time that he was supposed to have said it will end when, at the time when a green tree, this sounds weird, but stay with me, at a time when a green tree cut down in the middle of its trunk and the felled part carried 3 furlongs from the stump shall be joined again to its trunk by itself and without the hand of man or any sort of stake and begin once more to push leaves and bear fruit from the old love of its uniting sap. Then first can a remission of these great ills be hoped for. Which sounds, well, impossible. A tree doesn't just reassemble itself. Mm. And so the people at the time were like, oh, so are you sort of saying never? Anyway, I mentioned this before we get stuck in, because big part really, especially when you look back at it in hindsight, which of course has been done for 1,000 years nearly, this prediction about the green tree, this prophecy about the green tree, about when exactly did England sort of become England again? Because William the Conqueror and William Rufus were just so firmly Norman. Mm. They're not interested in assimilating, really, at all. So at what point can you say that England becomes English again? Mm. And so the reign of Henry I, historians start to say, is really the beginning of that process. Mm. And to get away from sort of wishy-washy prophecies.
Well, hang on a second. Okay. Just on. So the greenwood, the green trees, are a very old part of like English mythology, right? It's very deeply embedded in English folklore that there's something safe and sacred about the trees and the woods, right? And so I'm not surprised that a prophecy would be something about this kind of tree. And obviously, you know, who knows, you know, obviously that's, you know, nonsense, but it doesn't surprise me at all that this is in their minds, because it's got this kind of symbology about it, doesn't it? Mm. You know, it's sort of life and safety come from the woods in England, unlike in other places where you've got like bears and wolves and panthers and whatever. You know, that's just not how, and even at this point, you know, the woods of England would have been mostly safe. I mean, it's a few hundred years until wolves are entirely expunged from the British Isles, but there can't have been that many at this time, you know, even then. So, you know, it's just one of those things. It speaks to the cultural norms and sort of the way they looked at their own world, doesn't it? Mm. You know, it's like the green tree is important. So, okay. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, sort of leaves and fruits of the trees and sort of the green verdantness of the weald all speaks of life and rejuvenation and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, because there's a sort of weird effect that when you're in a forest and it's quiet, then you know there's a predator around. Right? And that's this, you know, the birds all go quiet. But if you actually go for a walk in England, they don't go quiet, you know, because there are no predators around. So you're always walking around with birdsong in your ears. And I've been in the woods, you know, I've been in my whole life going into the woods. I've never been in the woods where the birds have stopped singing. And yet you hear about this in like America or Russia or whatever. And so it's just like, okay, that's interesting, I think, you know. And so like it just speaks to me on a kind of, you know, mythological level, you know, where he's like, oh, the green tree has significance. So yeah, I feel that it does, you know, I don't know what it means. You know, and don't get me wrong, I don't think it's going to suddenly magically rejoin itself or anything, but I can see why that was the focus of the mythology rather than, you know, some like thing from the Middle East where it's out in the desert or something like this, you know.
I was going to say, a forest or a wood is sort of undeniably filled with life, which is very different to sort of a desolate mountainside or a desert or something where it sort of does speak of death in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, the forest desolation itself is life, you know.
But just more directly, the tree in this prophecy is directly a metaphor for England.
Right.
That the Norman Conquest has cleaved England in half. It's cut the tree down. The tree of England has been cut down. Mm-hmm. When, if ever, will it start growing again or regrow itself or reconnect itself? All these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Some historians say that it isn't really until the age of Henry II, which is quite a long time after this, where you can say, okay, we sort of definitely... I mean, even then, some might argue, well, they're Angevins. They're actually more, they're still quite French in some ways. But some historians say it's really with Henry I, you start to see this, if not a complete rebirth, at least some sort of fusion between the Normans and the English.
You know what's interesting? I saw, I follow a linguistics page on Facebook, because I'm a nerd, and I saw like the Lord's Prayer from like 950, and it's written in Anglo-Saxon and totally unintelligible. Can't read a word of it. And then by about, I think it was 1100, it's actually mostly readable. Like, and so it's interesting how quickly the language changed after the Norman Conquest. You know, it was actually really swift that this, the what I guess we call like more modern, or at least, you know, proto-modern English comes about. So when talking about like how quickly did England feel like England again? So, I mean, maybe it didn't take that long. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we start to see in the reign of Henry I, in various ways, we've said it before a few times, haven't we, that you can either stamp peoples under your jackboot or you can try and go native. And at least to some degree, he sort of goes native. I'll get into it, but he takes an English wife.
Right, okay.
And, you know, that all that sort of
thing.
That's
a good start, yeah.
If I could read a little paragraph from Nicholas Vincent. I think I may have will have read the first few lines of this in the previous epochs, but I'll read it again because it is sort of good in case anyone didn't see that one. Nicholas Vincent wrote, "In October 1100, hunting in the New Forest, William Rufus was accidentally shot through the heart by an arrow fired by one of his fellow huntsmen. Quite who fired the shot was never resolved, although most blamed Walter Tyrrell, Lord of Poix, near Amiens. Attempts to expose a conspiracy had enjoyed little support. Henry, Rufus's younger brother, was an unpleasant, ambitious and libidinous young man." Meaning he was very highly sexed, he liked the women's. Yeah. He took lots and lots of mistresses.
Not like Henry Rufus, though.
Yeah, the opposite. he had loads of illegitimate children, something like 20 or 30 illegitimate children. He'd have hunting lodges where he just had women there for him.
Right.
He was that.
Right, he's that kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah. Even Henry VIII or Charles II would have blushed at how... How much he was libidinous. He was a bit a libidinous young man. But even he was unlikely to have stooped to fratricide. This did not mean he was above scheming or making the very most of a godsend opportunity. Without even waiting for Rufus to be buried, Henry rode pell-mell for Winchester to grab the family treasury and then to London, where he was crowned in Westminster Abbey only 3 days later. Not as was customary by the Archbishop of Canterbury, but by the relatively junior Bishop of London. Now that suggests we just got to get this done now. Yeah, every moment sort of counts almost, which, you know, says a lot, doesn't it? The speed here and the fact that he immediately issued a coronation charter promising to revoke various of the more serious abuses of Rufus's regime indicate the panic of the moment. There was still no agreed procedure for royal succession, and the victor of any succession dispute was likely to be the person closest to the scene of the late king's death, with the fastest horses and the speediest access to the royal treasury. Henry's seizure of the throne of England was a coup d'etat just as dramatic and controversial as Rufus's accession 13 years earlier. Once again, Robert Curteaux, the oldest brother, was deprived of what he believed to be his right.
Poor old Robert over in Normandy.
Yeah. In fact, I think he was on his way back from Crusade.
Really?
He wasn't even in Normandy at this moment. It wasn't long. I think it was just a few months.
Yeah.
But he was actually literally on his way back still because Jerusalem had fallen the previous year. Okay, so one of the first things you have to get into really is this sort of immediate showdown, really, because as I say, just a few months later, Curteaux is back on the scene and he's like, come on, not again. You know, this. I'm not having this. It's happening again, the same thing. Yeah. And this is my little brother now.
Yeah.
This isn't Rufus, who's almost my equal. I'm only a couple of years older. This is my little bro, who's like 20 years younger than me. This kid, my kid brother, has stolen England.
Yeah.
Anyway, apparently, Curteaux launches an invasion attempt,
mm-hmm.
more or less straight away, within a year or so. And he lands. He actually crosses the channel and lands with a body of a small army.
Mm.
And what Henry does is just bribes him. I think with like £3,000, which is a lot of money. But Curteaux takes that bribe. We don't know all the details of that, whether he thought, well, I'm just not in a position to do this, or whether he lost his nerve, or whether he really needed the money. Mm. We don't know the dynamic of what went on there. But he accepted the bribe and went back to Normandy.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's not like he's doing terribly, is it? You know,
right,
he's got £3,000 in Normandy in his pocket. You know, he's going to be, what, in his mid-40s?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, so,
I would assume that he must have just thought, okay, I've got time.
Yeah.
There's no immediate rush. It doesn't have to be now or never.
Mm.
And that I really need that money for whatever reason.
But, I mean, if he's bribing you, then he's surely revealing a position of weakness here. But
like,
Henry, yeah.
Right, yeah. Well,
so,
yeah.
Okay, I'll take that £3,000 and buy some mercenaries.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was obviously in both parties' interest to do that rather than have a battle.
Yeah.
Because battles are, obviously we said it before, haven't we?
Chance.
But it's, you're not managing risk. You're just dialing up your risk there.
Oh, yeah.
Because even if it looks like you're likely to win, you could lose.
Yeah. And it's all or nothing as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could die on the battlefield, as many people did, only like, 50 years ago.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And one thing to say, where Robert Curteaux has been on Crusade successfully was one of the main lights on the First Crusade, and he's come back. It gives you incredible prestige, just incredible. You're sort of, I've heard another historian say it before, it's like going to the Olympics and winning a medal.
Mm.
If you come back from that, it's like an undeniable stamp that you're the real deal.
It's kind of more than that, though, isn't
it? Because it's even more than that.
Like,
yeah.
You know, if someone was like, oh, I've won an Olympic medal, I'd be like, okay, I don't really care about the Olympics, you know. But there's not anyone in England who's like, I don't really care about Christianity, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like walking into like a sports hall with an Olympic medal.
Okay,
we've got all these training, these young athletes training. They're all really invested, and you're an Olympian. Mm. You know that that's like, oh wow, you know. Okay, well, what's his advice? You know, this is it's important.
No one in 1100 is saying, that First Crusade is, well, they wouldn't have called it the First Crusade, but that crusade was nothing really. Everyone's blowing it out of all proportion.
Exactly.
No one was saying that.
Yeah, no one thought like this, you know.
To cut ahead, they just want the story of Curteaux. They have on and off strife between each other. It's just on and off. And it comes to a head in 1106, the Battle of Tanquebray, where Henry wins that battle.
Remarkable. Has Henry ever had a battle before?
I'm not sure. I don't know, actually. I don't think so. Where he's the commander in the field sort of thing. I don't think so, actually. Good question.
And he's got his veteran crusading brother, who must know all about war at this point.
Oh, yeah,
because we'll have to do a thing on the First Crusade at some point.
We've got to. Yes.
Because it's quite staggering accomplishment.
I think we need to do a series on that, Carl. Anyone in the comments wants to back me up on that.
we will. He must know what he's doing.
Yeah, right. But Henry's army was, he had lots of very, very capable captains and lieutenants under him. But they had this big showdown at Tanker Bray, and Churchill, I think, said, it's the most important battle for certainly Northwestern Europe, if not all of Europe or Western Europe, since 1066. It was pivotal. If that went the other way, all of Western European history would be different. We almost certainly would have a King Robert I of England if that battle went the other way. It was really, really super pivotal battle. But because it sort of reinforced the status quo, you know, Henry had already been king for six years here, it sort of gets lost a little bit.
I've never even heard of it.
Right.
Which is weird because I'm a big fan of military history. See, I would have thought I would have known about this.
And just to very quickly say then about Curteaux, he's captured there. Mm-hmm. Henry puts him in prison and doesn't let him out ever until they die of old age, like 30 years later. The rest of Curteaux's life is in prison for 30 years. He doesn't die until he's in his 80s.
Famous crusader. Yeah. He's your brother. Yep. He's the Duke of Normandy. You're like, I'm just going to leave him in prison. Screw that guy.
Puts him in prison in Wales, I believe, for like 30 odd years. It's one of those things we said about William the Conqueror is and his children are the same. If you're noble, if you're blue-blooded, if you're landed and things, they very rarely execute you.
Yeah.
Very, very rarely execute you.
30 years in prison probably isn't fun.
Yeah. Well, apparently it was that type of imprisonment where you're not in a cell drinking water and eating bread only. He was at liberty within the grounds of a certain castle.
Right, okay.
But it's just, it's a house arrest in a castle. Okay. But still, your liberty is taken away.
Yeah.
Apparently he spent his time, just a quick aside, learning Welsh and writing poetry. And so some historians have said that sort of speaks volumes about his character. He's a little bit weak. He didn't try and really contrive an escape plan or any of that. He just says, I'm in prison now. I'll just learn Welsh and things.
I get the feeling you probably would have been a better king, though.
Maybe. Maybe. Well, they said he was, even though he was a great crusader, certainly a great warrior in sort of, you know, one-to-one combat and things.
Yeah.
He was a bit too weak when it came to dominating his magnates.
Right.
And so that meant they could sort of take advantage of him and set up themselves in, it was a bit, the word shiftless comes up a lot.
Really?
Yeah. So maybe not. I think you did need a strong hand at that point.
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly.
But
especially
who knows?
This time, Jesus.
Right, yeah. Who knows how things would have gone, but that is sort of the end of Curteaux. He does have a son, though. A Cleto, he's called. And he was only like 4 years old. Sorry?
Is that some sort of old Frankish name?
Yeah, yeah. It's a Frankish type thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.